Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We're going to be talking about the Billy Meier case today, specifically Contact Report 215. And I'm also going to go back over Contact Report 10, or bits and pieces of that, which is the beginning of the spiritual teachings. Still struggling with sound with Blog Talk. I did not get around to pre-recording myself. So we're going to go live. We're going to see how it all comes out. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it won't. Anyway, Edward Albert Meyer, Billy Meyer, is a 77-year-old man. He lives in a tiny mountain village in Hinterschmidruti, which is a little village maybe an hour east of Zurich. Some interesting facts you might not know about Billy. Billy has created some 40 books. He's written 40 books, which is an incredible amount of books. I didn't realize that. I've just brought Eve onto the air. Thank you, Eve. We can hear you, so I know you're out there listening, and let me know if things don't sound so good, and, you know.
I sure will.
Don't, you know, don't yell any cuss words or have a hysterical fit. don't burp or, you know, make any other disgusting rude sounds. Of course, unless you want to, which is fine. I don't mind that at all, but anyway.
Well, good luck with this. I couldn't even pronounce some of those words.
Well, a hyenodon is one of them. We're going to talk tonight also about ancient times. It's really interesting because if you go back 65 million years ago, a meteor hit the Earth and it wiped out the dinosaurs. And it took a while for life to come back on the Earth. But the beginning of life starting again was the era called the Paleocene era. And it's interesting, the Paleocene era is when the Rocky Mountains were formed. And we started to have the appearance of placental mammals then. Now, and there was this really, and that lasted, how long did that last? That lasted about 15 million years, the Paleocene era. So you see the Rocky Mountains form. Mammals are starting to appear. Remember, the dinosaurs got wiped out in that meteor that hit the Earth. And it's interesting, but meteors, we seem to get these extinction events about every 20, 25 million years, which seems so long if you think about it. But in terms of geological time, it's really not that long. Anyway, after the Paleocene era, after the dinosaurs were wiped out, we start getting mammals appearing on the Earth. Now, there's a 100,000-year period after the Paleocene era. And this is an interval of maximum temperature. They don't know exactly what happened or why it occurred, but there was a kind of global warming that occurred between the Paleocene era and the Eocene era. The Eocene era occurred from 56 million years ago to about 34 million years ago. That was a time of warm climates, and we had the rise of more modern mammals. The Himalayan mountains were formed, and then we went into the Oligocene era, which was 34 to 23 million years ago. It included more mammals being developed, and the appearance of true carnivores. And there was this great extinction event that occurred, another extinction event that occurred at the end of the Eocene era going into the Oligocene era. And it's sometimes called the Great Break in Continuity. There was a large-scale extinction, a flora and faunal turnover, and it was a meteorite strike again. And they say it occurred in Chesapeake Bay And another also hit in central Siberia. So we keep having these extinction events, which occur about every 20, 25 million years ago. When did man come in? Well, the first beings that were recognizable as humans appeared about 8.5 million years ago. And I'll read line 41 from Contact 215. It says, the development of these beings lasted for a very long time, with the most diverse species following from it, which developed into actually recognizable humans in their first species, even the early hominids, as the Earth person imagines them in the early stages. The earliest stages were like 8.5 million years ago, when an upright walking hominid that started to appear in its facial structure and look somewhat like a person. And I want to get back to this later, and we'll talk about these two very, very interesting creatures, one called the Hyaenodon and the other called the Entelodon. And these were very powerful and somewhat large predators that roamed almost every continent on the Earth at that time. They were bigger than lions, some of these, and they had very razor sharp teeth. So, but before we get to that, I, for whatever reason, felt motivated to talk about Contact Report 10 again, and to go back over some of the spiritual teachings. Billy is a very prolific writer, as I was mentioning at the beginning of the program. He's written actually over 40 books, which is a pretty incredible accomplishment. And there is a film out on YouTube you can watch. It's called you just look up Figu Canada and you'll find it. It's the beginning of the Billy Meyer contact information. So it's very interesting that a person would write that many books if he wasn't completely committed to what he was doing. Anyway.
With one hand?
With one hand. Eve, you're still there listening. Yes, with one hand, which is quite a accomplishment. Anyway, the initial Contact Report 10 occurred on Wednesday, March 26, 1975. And Semyase started to talk to Billy about the human spirit. And she said that a human spirit does not die nor sleep during its deepest sleep. It records all thoughts and motions. It informs the human whether his thoughts are correct or false if he has learned to pay attention. Semyase called the human spirit the wonder of all wonders, and she explained that all power comes from the human spirit. She also said that those who are rich in spirit will become an instrument through which the creation can reveal the spiritual realms. And the human spirit is this tiny needle point of energy that appears in the superior colliculus of a child at 21 days after the sperm fertilizes the egg. And the energy from that spirit form spreads evenly over the whole body like a filigree. And it animates every cell in the human body. The spirit form is what lasts between lifetimes. We live many, many lifetimes. If you count the time on the spirit side as well as the time in the physical, we live about 40 to 60 million years going between the spiritual realms and back into the physical. Before and then after that time period, humans go into a part physical and part spiritual state. And there are seven stages of evolution, and we can talk about that again. But inside this area of the brain, it's called the superior colliculus. And that's an area in the midbrain, and that's where the spirit form comes. Well, something else happens when you incarnate into the physical again. Something called the consciousness block goes into your frontal lobe, so to speak. Your consciousness block is your new personality for this lifetime. It's also your ego. We get a new material consciousness in every lifetime so that we have different points of view in each lifetime. And those differing points of view allow us or help us to gather wisdom, because wisdom is the purpose of our life. And wisdom leads to evolution. And what happens when the spirit form comes into the body, the heart starts to beat, all the cells of the body are enlivened, the consciousness block comes into the brain, the new personality is formed, the fetus goes off of impulse evolution to something called consciousness evolution. And when the consciousness block comes in, what also comes in your subconscious, are the wisdom of your previous lifetimes. So when you grow back up as a child again, you're going to get impulses from the storage banks, as well as inspiration from your subconscious. So what are impulses, and what are these? What is the storage bank? In the German, the word for storage bank is Speicherbank. The storage bank archive for the general spiritual teaching is called the strudel. And a general definition of archive is a place where public records are stored, public records that have permanent, enduring cultural, historical value. And these, the Speicherbank, the strudel, the storage bank for the spiritual teaching, is not a physical place, but it's available as a kind of energy. And, for example, now, Billy Meyer, Edward Albert Meyer, knows how to pull this information out of the storage banks. When he wrote the book, The Goblet of Truth, he pulled the first 14 chapters of The Goblet of Truth out of the terrestrial storage banks. Now, so the terrestrial storage banks, the strudel, which is the storage bank archive for the public spiritual teaching, is accessible, it's available, it's open to the public, and the word is zugänglich, which in the German means available. Now, Billy got impulses from the storage banks as a small child. And he has a wonderful writing called How It All Began, which you can find up at the Future Mankind site. And let me read from How It All Began. It says, "The words suddenly formed on my lips again, which said, 'Since ancient times, you have lived among the stars.' And suddenly I knew who I was, how I am, and what my mission is on this earth. And suddenly impulses came from somewhere, which I later recognized as impulses from the storage banks, and many good memories penetrated me and showed me the way to go." So you can think of these impulses from the storage banks as like a signal. So we're getting these signals from the universal consciousness. These signals are designed to help us evolve. Now, unfortunately, and this is just some of my own observation, not necessarily anything from that I've read directly from the Meyer material, but unfortunately, in the third millennium, it seems that people are becoming less and less sensitive. And I think this is by choice. I think we're desensitizing ourselves intentionally because subconsciously we recognize that so many things are wrong with the world around us. And in order to cope, it's a coping mechanism, we desensitize ourselves. Now, in many ways we do this. We can do it through alcohol. We can do it through drugs. People do it through entertainment, and they focus on sports, or they just kind of turn their minds off, and it helps them to avoid the difficulty, to bear the responsibility for the state of our Earth, which is in a very, very difficult place. But we should stay sensitive, so we can think clearly, and so we can get these signals from the storage bank. Now, in medicine, a signal could be your brain signaling your hand to move when the energy from that electrical impulse goes down the nerve to cause your brain to move. So a signal usually carries some kind of information. It's an impulse. And we get these signals from the universal consciousness, and they're designed to help us evolve. Now, each one of us has this human spirit, which is the bearer of the creative realm. And that's what the Meyer material explains it as. Now, to create means to be creative, to evolve from one's own thoughts, from one's own imagination. For example, a work of art is an example of a creation. Now, the spirit within the human is the bearer of the creative realm. A realm is a community, a territory, which a sovereign rules over. You rule over your spirit, your creative realm. The German word, which is translated as realm, is Reiches, which means realm, domain, kingdom, empire. Now, the interesting word here, one of the interesting German words, is Träger. And Träger is translated as bearer. But it also has the meaning as of a receptacle, a place where things are deposited and stored. So what happens when you die? The spirit form leaves the body and it goes in the spiritual realm, but your consciousness block also transfers into the spirit realm. The consciousness block goes into what's called the overall consciousness block. And what happens is the information from your life, which is can be turned into something which something they call an evolutive value, which could be wisdom, creativity, patience, love. All of these things can be used as an evolutive value. And that's what will help us evolve. Now, this spirit form, it resides in the superior colliculus. And that's the area of our mind that controls our eye movements, and it's the area of the mind that controls our gaze, which is also interesting. In line 14, Semyase started to talk more about the human being, and she said, that's why the terrestrial philosophers of old spoke about the human as the microcosm within the macrocosm. Because everything that is included within the universe is included within the human. Now, this is really profound. And the microcosm and the macrocosm is kind of a Neoplatonic schema of seeing patterns reproduced in all levels of the cosmos, from the smallest level, which is the microcosm, to the largest level, which is the macrocosm. So let me give some examples of this again. The repeating patterns of nature. The pattern of the electron rotating around the nucleus, which is analogous in the macrocosm to the planet rotating around the star. Fractals can be found in trees. A tree branch grows with a kind of repeating pattern. And the pattern in the tree branch is similar to the branching structures in the human circulatory system, which is similar to the branching structure of lightning when there's a lightning strike. So what we see are these repeating patterns in nature. We see the spiral of the double helix in the DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. We see the spiraling arms of the galaxy. Semyasu said that the inner dimensions of the human are endless. A dimension is a measurement in length, width, and thickness. Space-time is said to have three dimensions of space and one of time. The fourth dimension is often said to be time in the theory of general relativity. Semyasu also said something profound about happiness. She said that if a human is happy, his happiness comes from within, because happiness is a self-created state. Happiness is never a location. Joy comes forth from the human's inner part, created by spiritual poise. Happiness is contentment. Satisfaction is a part of happiness, and satisfaction means to fulfill the desires, the expectations, the needs. Happiness is something that evolves from the evolution of our own thoughts. Poise can be defined as a state of balance or equilibrium. Remember, the universal consciousness always exists in an equilibrium, a neutral, positive state. The universal consciousness is either good nor evil. It's a neutral, positive entity. It has this balance or equilibrium. And Semyasi explained that joy comes forth and it's created by spiritual poise. Poise means a dignified, self-confident manner or being. Poise can mean steadiness and stability. And the German word that is translated as poise here is Ausgeglichenheit, which means calmness, even temper, and equilibrium. Remember, the universal consciousness is always trying to create an equilibrium. And you can see this in nature. Everything tries to create an equilibrium. Water will find its level point, its equilibrium level. Nature abhors a vacuum because it wants to create balance. And therefore, there is only one existence that rules throughout the universe, only one creation, one knowledge, and one wisdom. And that knowledge is synchronous. And in the sense of oneness, the creation is unchanging in that sense. It's always a oneness. But of course, the creation evolves. Now, Spoth explained the oneness of the universe to Billy when Billy was a very young boy. He said that in the entire universe, everything is one and it's bound together. And he also stated, however, the oneness and connectedness with all and everything is the result of the might and the immeasurable love of creation. Now, creation is not completely graspable for us. It has immeasurable love. It has immeasurable wisdom. But it's said to be a Weisenheit in the German. Weisenheit refers to things... how can I say this? A water is a Weisenheit. Our atmosphere is a Weisenheit. The universal consciousness is a Weisenheit. It's not a religious deity. It's not a god. It is immeasurable in its wisdom and its love, but it functions in many ways almost robotically, automatically. It has no personality. So the universal consciousness expresses its love through nature. And Billy wrote, "The incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation. And the creation radiates love so that every moment and every place that you can experience the radiating love of creation." And love is the highest principle in creation. And through this principle, everything exists. Nothing would exist that does exist if it were not for the radiating love of creation. And every tiny plant and every tiny animal fulfills its purpose in creation. And we can see the love of creation in the construction of nature. We should be able to stand and analyze a tree and see this love. Now, there's something called wisdom conditioned love, which is a harmonious state of absolute connectedness with all things. And the German word for connectedness here is Verbundenheit. Verbundenheit can be translated as spiritual affinity, closeness, a connectivity. The law of love is said to be a creational law. And some of Billy's book, he has a book called The Law of Love, which can be found at the Future of Mankind website. And Billy defined love as, love is absolute certainty of oneself living and existing in everything, in fauna, in flora, in the fellow human being, in each material and each spiritual life form of any kind, and in the existence of the entire universe and beyond it. And Semyase described this love. She said, love and wisdom belong together because the creation and its laws are love and wisdom at the same time. Liebe is the German word for love. Weisheit is the German word for wisdom and sagacity. Now, I want to read something from Fige Bulletin 69, which says, our individual evolutionary level is, of course, decisive, depending on whether or not our predecessor personalities, the ones who came before us, recognize their responsibility and evolutionize their consciousness as far as possible. If they haven't, our inner self is not congeneric, like-natured, with the innermost self, or in other words, with the knowledge, love, and wisdom impulses of creation. And these wisdom impulses of creation flow into our spirit form and into our subconscious and into our consciousness, where we, upon seizing upon them, continue to evolve from these love impulses. Well, I advertised this show not as the spiritual teaching, But I think it's always good to go over this information. What I'm going to do is we began the show out, and I was talking about these ancient prehistoric creatures, which are mentioned in Contact 215. Now, I have a pretty long clip that talks about these ancient predators, and I'll go ahead and play that, and we can listen. This is a very good clip.
Imagine a predator with jaws like a guillotine.
Pound for pound, this is one scary animal.
Hyaenodon wreaked havoc across the plains of North America for over 10 million years.
Let's say it grabbed my arm. The rear teeth would slice through it like a samurai sword.
But this carnivore wasn't the only predator dominating the landscape. Hyaenodon had two deadly enemies. These predators were locked in an epic battle where only one would survive. Million years ago, as the Oligocene epoch began, the environment of planet Earth was very different from today. Warmer temperatures meant no polar ice caps. So a place like Antarctica was a lush pine forest. But then, the climate began to change. North American temperatures dropped. With all the open landscape and a huge population of prey animals, North America became a predator's paradise.
North America had an amazingly rich fauna. Some people compared it to what we have in the African savanna today.
This abundant group of mammals would never be recognized today. There were 90-centimeter-high mini horses called Mesohippus, small camels without humps, and rhinos without horns. The most common was a sheep-like animal, the oreodont.
This is an oreodont. It's a fossil sheep, an ancestor to sheep and goats. This was a very tasty animal.
At any given moment, the serenity of an open meadow could turn into chaos. The architect of this mayhem was the top predator of its time, Hyaenodon.
This is Hyaenodon hordes, the biggest and baddest animal that lived in the Oligocene Badlands. It was king of the Badlands.
This creature had a massive head, perched on a stout body. It was much larger than most of the animals it hunted.
The Oligocene was terribly, terribly busy. There were more animals hunting than there are in modern-day Africa.
Hyaenodon's competition included a saber-toothed cat called Dinictus. But the most bizarre was an aggressive pig-like creature with a nasty attitude, the Entelodont. The struggle between these two mega beasts would go on for 5 million years. Paleontologists marvel at Hyaenodon's amazing characteristics. But this creature is a mystery. it is a difficult mammal to study because few fossils have ever been found. There is only one complete skeleton on the entire planet, at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City.
Only when you have a fully mounted one like this do you have an idea of what this thing really looked like.
Dr. Jim Millett is a world-renowned expert on Hyaenodon. He has been studying the beast for over 30 years.
It packed an enormous amount of power into its jaw muscles. Once it caught up with something, the guillotine-like teeth would make short work of any prey.
In laboratories across America, experts are examining this elusive predator.
Fossils are rare, but finding a top-end carnivore is even more difficult. Carnivores are very, very rare because there are very few of them living at any one time.
With very little fossil evidence, scientists have to piece this puzzle together, literally one bone at a time.
About 13 of them, so we can count 1, 2, 3.
This is one of our most complete skeletons. You can see it's not very complete. It's not beautifully preserved, but it's the best that we have, and they are quite rare, as carnivores always are. Now, the preservation isn't exceptional, but it's the best you can do in the Badlands sometimes.
These are the Badlands of South Dakota. Here, the volcanic soil contains a goldmine of fossil evidence because of the dense population of prehistoric animals that once lived in this area. These dry river and lake beds reveal extreme events of nature where a flash flood might have surprised and killed thousands of animals. A layer of mud then preserved their bones for millions of years.
This animal is in a death position. It died in place and sediments covered it. Chemicals in the groundwater impregnated the bone and made the bone harder and more durable. So it was able to last 30 million years, say.
The erosion of the landscape over the course of 30 million years has been so dramatic that fossils can be found nearly everywhere.
This bone was in the ground, but we've had a lot of rain here recently, all flooding rain, and it's been scouring this hillside, not just this hillside, the entire Badlands. So the fossils are jumping out of the ground. They're being released by the rain and coming out.
The first fossils of Hyaenodon were discovered in the Badlands during the mid-1800s. These precious bones were sent to Philadelphia, where Dr. Joseph Leidy first described the animal.
He named Hyaenodon, which simply means hyena tooth. Don means tooth, and hyena is self-explanatory. And if I picked this skull up, I wouldn't necessarily call it hyena-like teeth, but he must have thought that it looked very much like a hyena. And so this was the name that he provided.
But Dr. Leidy may have jumped to the wrong conclusion when he named this 30-million-year-old predator after the hyena.
Oftentimes you're stuck with names that are just unfortunate. Maybe Hyaenodon is one of them.
When modern scientists began to carefully study Hyaenodon, they could find very little similarity between it and its modern namesake.
Hyena and Hyaenodon are not related at all. They're quite different animals and with quite different ancestries.
The most striking disparity is their head size and posture. If a line is drawn down the spine of both animals, the difference is clear. The hyena's spine is steeply sloping, revealing two short rear legs. Without the modern hyena to use as reference, scientists were puzzled over what Hyaenodon might have looked like. When they looked at its skull, the bony plate on the roof of its mouth extends past the back teeth, so they thought it might be an anteater. They even considered a sea creature.
The only other animal that we can think of that has a prolonged bony palate is a dolphin. This is Flipper. You can see the teeth. The teeth end here, and the bony palate continues toward the rear of the jaw. So some people originally thought that Hyaenodon might have been...
Paleontologists depend on modern animals to put a face on the fossils they dig from the ground. But in this case, there's a problem.
Anytime you have a fossil animal as bizarre and out of the ordinary as Hyaenodon, you have difficulty trying to figure out what it did, how it looked, how it ran.
Using new technology, Dr. Millett suggests building a hybrid model of the beast, borrowing components from similar predators. They start with the wolf, an animal with the same stance and dog-like behaviors as the Hyaenodon.
I take the skull from the Hyaenodon and take the head off the wolf.
The wolf has much longer legs, which allow it to run faster. They have to shorten the legs to match the size and stance of a Hyaenodon.
Now that looks really bizarre. The skull looks so huge, it looks as if the animal were standing there, the head would tip it forward.
The wolf body is too small for the Hyaenodon's head, so Dr. Millett chooses a prehistoric predator as a model for Hyaenodon's body type, the saber-toothed cat.
Saber-toothed cats are much more heavily built. When they did their attacks on larger prey, they were almost bear-like in the way they would run on something.
The saber-toothed body fits much better with the head of Hyaenodon, except for the shoulder muscles, meaning that the cat's front legs were much stronger than Hyaenodon's.
Can you eliminate the high bump?
Sure, let me just paint those down here.
Can you reduce the size of the limb muscles?
Reducing the cat's leg muscles brings the model very close to Hyaenodon. But there's one last adjustment, the tail length.
So if you can take the tail and make it about twice as long. Now we've got an animal that looks like a real critter. That's really good.
Hyaenodon was more like a big cat than a wolf, because it needed a bulky body for its large head. It ran on short, muscular legs that could quickly accelerate, but also had the power to cover long distances. The question is, how did all these parts work together to make this creature one of the fiercest predators of its time? The massive head of Hyaenodon is an exquisite killing machine. The unique design of this creature's teeth and jaws make it one of the most dangerous predators ever to walk the earth.
Let's say I got caught out in the open and it grabbed my arm. And the first bite would crush both bones in my arm. And as the bite continued, the rear teeth would slice through it like a samurai sword.
This is Hyaenodon horridus. This is a large horridus. This is 15 inches of ferocious terror. This is one of the largest skulls of Hyaenodon horridus known. Big, big skull. Big teeth, teeth the size of a grizzly bear.
Behind four large, deadly canines was a mouth full of razor-sharp teeth.
The way this thing attacked prey would be visualizing, let's say, a pit bull with a guillotine in its mouth.
The beast had a set of eight slicing teeth, four on each side of the jaw.
As long as you've got a really sharp cutting edge, you can chop that food up into small pieces. The smaller the pieces are chopped up, the more quickly it can be digested, the more quickly it's made available to the animal.
Hyaenodon's jaw had an advantage that no other mammal has ever had. Its teeth stayed in perfect alignment for the life of the beast. For most other predators, their teeth wear down to nubs as they get older, so they can't slice up meat. When they can no longer process food, they starve to death.
Hyaenodonts solved this problem in a way that no other mammal did it. What happened was the teeth over a lifetime rotated inward. And you can see on this very aged one, the equivalent of a 90-year-old in human terms, the cutting edge is actually going across the roots of the teeth.
In order to maintain the close contact essential for chewing, the upper teeth rotated inward and the lower teeth rotated outward. These self-sharpening teeth meant that even in old age, the animal could chew up a carcass.
Even for an animal that has got all the enamel worn off its teeth, it's still maintaining a cutting edge between the upper and lower jaws.
Hyaenodon also had another devastating weapon, bite force.
Pound for pound, this is one scary animal.
At Australia's University of New South Wales, Dr. Stephen Rowe has turned a hyaenodon skull into a digital testing ground, where he can measure the bite strength of its razor-sharp jaws.
Hyaenodon is biting as hard as a large African lion.
When Dr. Rowe crash-tested the skull, he found that hyaenodon's head and jaw muscles could produce about 270 kilograms of bite force. Hyaenodon's jaws were even more deadly near the back of its mouth, because the bite force of its meat-slicing teeth was three times greater than that of its front canine teeth.
There is relatively little sophistication involved in a hyaenodon kill. This is an animal that just got in there and applied tremendous bite force to crush its potential prey.
Paleontologists like Jaff Boyce have spent years searching the Badlands, sifting for evidence of predation from the Oligocene epoch.
I found this a few days ago, and it was kind of wet out here, and it was too fragile to rescue at that time, but I'm going to try to get it uncovered here.
Boyce has found evidence of a ferocious hyaenodon attack in a place most people would never look. Animal feces, also known as coprolites.
All these are coprolites, fossilized feces, and these coprolites are from carnivores. We know they're from carnivores because they're high in calcium.
Inside the coprolites, Boyce found remnants of a horse skull that had been crushed, digested, and then discharged. Most predators would never bite into the skull of a prey animal because they might break their teeth.
There's very little meat on a skull, so you leave the skulls alone. There was only one animal that had strong enough jaws, strong enough teeth, strong enough desire in its ferociousness to eat a skull, and that's hyaenodon.
The smoking gun was the 30 million year old front incisor tooth that was still completely intact.
You can see how the teeth are the same shape. Probably the reason that this is in the coprolite is the hyaenodon grabbed the horse, crushed its nostrils, crushed the front of its face in order to kill it, and then swallowed what he had in his mouth.
Hyaenodon's mouth opened wide enough to fit around a prey animal's skull, so it could crush it in one bite. Years of field research have helped establish the sheer strength of hyaenodon, but its intelligence is less well understood. Such a huge head could indicate hyaenodon had plenty of space for a large brain. Now, with CAT scan technology, Dr. Larry Whitmer can look inside the skull of hyaenodon and gain an extraordinary view of this animal as if it was still alive. But after 30 million years, the skull has fossilized into rock, making it difficult to distinguish the true size and shape of the brain cavity.
The biggest problem we have is we don't really know what we're supposed to find. This is the first time we've ever CAT scanned hyaenodonts, so we don't really know what to expect.
Dr. Whitmer discovers that most of Hyaenodont's skull was filled with jaw muscles, leaving very little space for its brain. But he also finds amazing bioengineering that allowed the animal to get maximum efficiency out of these muscles.
When the animal was actually chewing and attacking and biting and potentially clamping down on prey, it would have had a problem with those large jaw muscles closing down the airway.
In order to eat and breathe at the same time, Hyaenodont developed a remarkably long nasal tube.
So by having this long bony tube extending all the way to the almost the very end of the head, it allows the animal to have a large prey item filling up its mouth, yet still breathe through its nose. Really quite a dramatic adaptation.
Hyaenodont's brain is divided into three small lobes, devoted to intelligence, smell, and coordination.
The amount of the brain that was devoted to the sense of smell was absolutely enormous, suggesting that the sense of smell, certainly in comparison to the sense of sight or hearing, was far more important to Hyaenodont than any of the other senses.
Dr. Whitmer believes that Hyaenodont's sense of smell was its primary method for finding prey. It could follow the scent of any animal from over 1.5 kilometers away. And when it came to the chase, Hyaenodonts relied on strength more than agility.
It probably didn't engage in sort of these rapid, fine, delicate kinds of predatory movements. It probably just ran in there sort of like a truck and mowed down its prey.
At the center of the brain was the neocortex. Its small size means that Hyaenodont wasn't an intelligent animal. But this wasn't a disadvantage, because 30 million years ago, no animal had the higher intelligence of modern predators and prey.
Hyaenodont really viewed its environment, you know, fairly coarsely. It couldn't really respond in sophisticated ways to wrinkles in its environment. It probably could be relatively easily fooled or bluffed. This was an animal that was driven more by instinct rather than by thought.
Hyaenodont's limited intelligence also meant it probably didn't hunt in packs.
It probably didn't have the brain power for the kind of cooperative hunting that we see in a lot of dog-like animals today, like wolves, that actually work as a team and sort of nip at their prey.
Hyaenodont's unique bioengineering gave it the tools to become a top predator. Still, it needed a diverse skill set to hunt down the many different kinds of prey animals in the wide-open grasslands of North America. If it didn't develop those skills, it was doomed. Thirty million years ago, North America's Great Plains were like a well-stocked supermarket for a carnivore like Hyaenodont. But the landscape was changing into more open country, so an ambush predator like Hyaenodont had to adapt to a different hunting strategy. There was one place where its razor jaws could get close enough to surprise and kill prey. A watering hole. In South Dakota's Badlands, paleontologists discovered an ancient watering hole that was the perfect fast food stand for an ambush predator like Hyaenodont.
So since 1993, we've found approximately between 8 and 10,000 bones. Which is a staggering number, especially for a quarry of this size.
This collection of bones is solid evidence of the large number of animals that were killed and eaten here.
Obviously, we can equate this to something that would happen like in Africa today. Everybody's got a drink. The predators know it, so they just sit and wait for easy kills, and that's probably what happened here.
water holes were a popular place for Hyaenodon to hang out, especially if there was any type of vegetation, where it would allow it to have some cover to get close enough to within a few yards of a horse while it's drinking.
But the horse that Hyaenodon hunted was nothing like the horses we know today.
This horse in front of me is known as Myohippus. It's one of the earlier horses from North America. Horses actually started out even half this big, but by the time of the Big Badlands, this is the common horse you see.
The Mesohippus was about one-third of the size of a modern-day horse.
Well, folks, our clip there is called Ancient Predators and Their Razor-Sharp Jaws. You can look that up on YouTube. I also put the link in the chat room. I'd like to thank all of you for coming to the show this evening. You're listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and I will be on Revolution Radio this evening with Sheldon Neidel, and Henry Kroll is my guests. That starts at 8 p.m. Eastern, Studio B at freedomslips.com. Special thank for Eve for checking our sound this evening. Anyway, we'll be back soon with more information in the Meyer case, and we'll be back again this evening at freedomslips.com, Studio B, with Sheldon Neidel and Henry Kroll. Have a good evening.